BBC London 94.9.
London's news. London's stories.
Well, just about managed to get the studio to work. If you could have seen the frantic and frenetic burrowing around by a team of engineers here at BBC London 94.9 just seconds before we went on air, you wouldn't believe it. Good afternoon, this is Ian Lee, sitting in for Robert Elms all this week. Don't worry though, we're not changing anything too much. I'm not coming in and doing a thrash metal special. Or a dance craze special. Nothing like that. We're going to be following the rules that Robert has laid down for me in his instruction book. Today we're celebrating 90 years of the Radio Times. The Radio Times was always the classy TV listings, wasn't it? So the kind of classier family's got the Radio Times. The not-so-classy family's got the TV Times. 90 years of the Radio Times. In a bit, we'll be talking to Simon Elms, who has written about various radio things involved with the BBC. He's also made two programmes marking the 90th birthday of the Radio Times. Speaking as well to Shem Law, Radio Times Art Director, and Rebecca Gilmore, Exhibitions Project Manager at the Museum of London, where they've got a special exhibition on about the RT. Maxwell Hutchinson will be in at about 20 to 1. And before the end of the show at 3, we'll have some music from John Terrell, formerly of Smooth and Terrell. If you want to take part, looking for your Radio Times memories, particularly keen to talk to you today if you've ever been on TV. That's kind of the main thread I want to follow in terms of your calls and your texts and your emails. Ever been on TV in a huge capacity or in a tiny, tiny capacity? Maybe you walked past Pat Butcher on EastEnders and you've got it on tape, and every time someone comes around you go, "Oh, have a look at this." Did I just say on tape? That's showing my age. Or if you've been on radio as well, we might as well. For years, as a kid, I couldn't work out why the Radio Times was called the Radio Times. But it's got TV listings in it. Man, was I dumb. If you want to get in touch, you can give us a call. 020-722-42000. You can text as well, 81333. Start your text with London. Or you can give me an email, ian.lee, ian.lee, at bbc.co.uk. But before that, should we have a little bit of music? Yes. Be rude not to, wouldn't it?
To me, than my love meant to you. back. I ain't trying to live in the past. I don't need your ass no more. You got a lot of love for your baby. You can't tell. Cause I'm taking time to find out how to love myself. Ain't nothing wrong. Ain't got no attitude. Yes, I still care. My love was vandalized and I apologize for my broken heart. I still got a lot of love for your baby. You can't.
This is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9, sitting in for Robert Elms. He's away for a week. Let the man have a break, for goodness sakes. Can't you? We're celebrating. With the hats off to the Radio Times. It's celebrating its 90th anniversary. And I'm joined now by Simon Elms, BBC Creative Director. You make features and documentaries, is that right?
That's right, yes.
And you've made a document, not one documentary, two documentaries.
Yes, I'm making a couple of documentaries about Radio Times. One about the music of Radio Times, which sounds really odd, but
yes,
there was a lot of music in Radio Times, particularly in the early days. And the art of Radio Times, because when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, Radio Times was, well, it came through the letterbox every whatever it was, every week, and I would leaf through it as a kid and look at the, and it was the pictures, it was not photographs, but it was drawings. So there was a huge school of line drawings, beautiful, very, very famous people, like a guy called Eric Fraser, who worked for 60 years for Radio Times. He now considered one of the greatest modern British line drawers, you know, artists in a great tradition.
So you've got these, let's talk about the art first of all then. You've got these two different documentaries. Yes, the drawings were fantastic. The illustrations were great. How have you got a whole documentary out of it? What's in there?
Well, we've talked to some artists. In fact, some of them are still around. The people who, you know, and when you look at Radio Times today, you think, well, there's no art in it. Actually, there's quite a lot of art. You know, there are logos. There are, on the radio pages, there are actual line drawings and some really beautiful paintings, actually. Think about your Christmas cover, and you'll see that they're often a beautiful illustration, a beautiful cover, and some of the best, you know, some of the most distinctive Radio Times covers were done for Christmas. I mean, the current editor, Ben Preston of Radio Times, points out in our programme that actually last year David Hockney did a cover for Radio Times. Yes, he did. They commissioned him specially to do a painting.
What was his cover? Was it the cast of EastEnders assembled in Albert Square or something?
No. He did one of his beautiful Yorkshire landscapes.
Wow.
And they gave away free copies. He did about six covers and they all gave them away as postcards. So, you know, it's true that there was a terrific tradition of celebrating. And actually, this takes you right back to the beginning of the BBC, because Lord Reith, when he started the BBC in 1922, and he used to write an editorial on the front page of Radio Times when it started in the first days.
Did he really?
Yes.
So where are we talking? 1923, wasn't it, when it started? Yes.
It started about a year and a half after the BBC itself. And he used to get six guineas for it, because it was it was always sort of slightly half in, half out of the BBC. Actually, it was not actually part of the BBC, although it was owned by the BBC. It was slightly odd circumstances. Anyway, and Lord Reith, you know, he had his inform, educate, and entertain ideas. But he wanted to infuse that with in the magazine as well. So you'll see that. I mean, but it was at the same time. The early BBC, as I wrote in my book about early BBC, Hello Again, which is just out in
that
Bend.
That's the history of radio, BBC radio.
History of
it?
Radio yes. voices, like yours, Ian. You so, know, people,
I
great
checked,
voices.
I checked the index. I'm not mentioned in there, yet people like Christian O'Connell are. What's that all about?
Well,
next edition.
You put me on the spot. No, seriously, though, the great thing about early radio was that it was a load of enthusiasm. I mean, Lord Reith seems a sort of rather old-fashioned figure now, but there were fantastic people who just were infused with the love of this new medium, wireless, that they were doing. And they were really, really, I mean, they were a bit bonkers sometimes.
Yep.
And one had been a great, he'd been recruited into the Royal Flying Corps when he was just 18, and he'd sort of shot down a few Red Barons over Germany. And he was a terrific guy. He got an Oscar for something later on. I mean, he was a really, really dynamic, clever man. Cecil Lewis, his name was. And then there was Peter Eckersley, who was the chief engineer. But he was the first radio star, actually. Mm. And he used to write a regular column on sort of valves and things like that, weird sort of engineering stuff.
A regular column on valves?
Well,
wow.
Yes.
I'm in. I'm hooked, son.
Well, to be honest, the new medium, people had things called cat's whiskers. They used to tune them in, and they were very, very sensitive, and it would all gurgle away, sort of, and these voices would sort of disappear up, sound like coming down the plug hole, actually. I mean, very weird sounding transmission, and they used to listen on headphones, very much like we do today,
but
that was before they invented loudspeakers. So it was a new medium. People were really, really excited about it.
I mean, radio has never gone away, and everyone always says, when TV came out, it's going to kill radio. But radio is still there, and the fact that the radio listings are still within the Radio Times and take up a significant portion of it,
absolutely,
prove that it's probably going to be with us forever, isn't it?
Radio is, well, look at your figures.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Radio is fantastic. I mean, you know, I don't say that because I work in it.
Mm.
I say it because I just look at the figures. I mean, the figures for radio listening are going up, and it's, you know, it seems not impervious to the internet, but the internet seems to sit very comfortably alongside this portable medium that we all love
instead of having when I was a kid, it was, you used to carry a tranny in your pocket, but now it's your phone. You can listen to radio stations all around the world, you know.
Absolutely. And that's the wonderful thing now. People can listen to BBC programs, listen to BBC London if you're in Los Angeles. I mean, you can, if you get up early enough in the morning, you know.
Well, yes, those American radio stations are awful, though, aren't they, for the most part? They're awful.
That was one of the reasons why the BBC is how it is, because they went over to America, the post office, who started the BBC, you know, had to license the BBC, went over to America, and they said, we can't be like this, because they were all broadcasting on the same wavelength, shouting over the top of each other, commercials and things. And nobody could hear anything. They said, we shall not be like this. So the BBC, that's why the BBC is sort of how it was, because it was the BBC.
Going back to the Radio Times, what is the relationship with the BBC? My dad, years and years ago, in the 70s and 80s, used to work in the prop department at Television Centre. And as a kid, I used to go and get to play with Daleks and the TARDIS. And every other week, he would bring home his free copy of the Radio Times that was given out to every member of staff. And I always assumed that it was kind of... It was owned by the BBC, it was printed on site by the BBC, but it's not quite, is it?
Well, it's always had a sort of half-in, half-out status, actually. I mean, and now it's actually independently owned, and it's part of something called Immediate Media now, these days. But that's for the last couple of years. Previous to that, it was part of BBC Worldwide, which was the commercial arm of the BBC, as it was called. But it was started by, the first editor was the editor of a magazine called Titbits, and it was had
I
this
beg
sort
your pardon,
of,
wasn't yeah, it was,
absolutely
where
Titbits.
Are we going with
it
this?
It was a sort of bits and pieces magazine, celebrity mag, and actually, it's always had that sort of half-in, half-out status, but it was the official organ of the BBC, as the original masthead said. So it was sort of the BBC, but sort of not. And I think the thing that is really makes it part of the BBC, like your dad was saying, is that it sort of is part of the British Fireside. They used to publish Fireside editions with often a very, very clever cartoon on the cover. I mean, they specialised in lovely, lovely covers from the very beginning.
Mm.
And it's sort of central to British, you know, 90 years, nearly a century.
Mm.
It's been there outselling an awful lot of other magazines. I mean, in its day, it sold 10 million copies a week.
Wow. I mean, it's still something like 800,000?
Nearly a million, actually.
Which is,
nine and a half.
Which is incredible. There's two things. We'll go back to the covers in a second. But I was surprised. I saw that figure today, nearly a million it sells. And there are so many cheaper and free alternatives to it. How has it managed to survive against all of that competition?
Well, I mean, what is it? It's a listings magazine. Mm. I mean, actually, when you think of it, it's the most boring thing in the world. A list of radio and TV programmes. I mean, what could be more boring? Except that that's exactly what it isn't, because actually it is part of, as I say, it's central to the British experience, like the BBC has been, like it or loathe it. It is part of the British culture, and it has been for a very long time. So I think the thing is about Radio Times, it was always a magazine, and I know that Ben Preston, the current editor, says that's what it is. It's Radio Times magazine. He gives a lot of space to articles that allow people, it's going to sit on your coffee table at Christmas for a couple of weeks. So it's always been sort of something much more than just boring grey listings. Mm. I mean, the very first edition, believe it or not, Ian, the very first edition of Radio Times, dated September the 28th, 1923, contained the sheet music of a song, a complete song.
Fantastic.
that was in fact the prize winning song in a competition that the Wireless had been holding.
But sheet music was huge. That's Absolutely. How publishers made their money in the 20s and 30s through selling sheet music. Yeah. So that would be a great thing to get for free.
Yeah, and at Christmas they would print Christmas carols, new, slightly offbeat Christmas carols, so you could sit round the old Joanna and sing it over Christmas when you weren't listening to Lord Reith's religious services, because they did a lot of that as well. But, you know, it was, you know, it's always much more than just a set of boring 9 a.m. listen to this and 10 o'clock.
You mentioned the cover, and the cover has always been kind of that's the iconic image. And it was always a big deal. I remember in the 70s and 80s, always a big deal to get on the front page of the Radio Times. Is it still seen as such a big deal to get on there now?
I can't say I speak for the Radio Times. I'm a radio producer and a lover of radio. I think that it personally, if I look at Radio Times on the newsstands now, I don't think it stands out like it used to. I think the Christmas edition certainly does.
Yep.
And when they do something like the Hockney, you're not going to have David Hockney sitting on the front cover of most magazines. However, most of the time it's, you know, EastEnders or whatever. Though they did point out that Call the Midwife, they did a painting, a sort of 50s style painting for Call the Midwife when that was having its first outing. And, you know, they try and do things that are a bit more distinctive. Mm. But in the great, I mean, they used to have special editions back in the 1920s, 30s. I think the high watermark for Radio Times, actually, as a distinctive magazine, was about 1935, 36, where they had these absolutely gorgeous, I mean, I can't tell you how beautiful they are, drawings for their holiday summer edition and for a fireside edition, for a spring number. Mm. They do a spring number. They were, I mean, really high quality, beautiful line drawings, coloured, always coloured. The Christmas edition with a wonderful Harlequin, very go-ahead, very modernist style. Very surprising, actually, because in those days, broadcasting was seen as, you know, what perhaps the internet is seen as today, or some new form of communication. It was the absolute cutting edge, particularly when television came on board in 1936. And, you know, the magazine reflected that in their covers. They had these, I mean, really, you know, the exhibition at the Museum of London, I'm longing to see it, because actually they have got these wonderfully beautiful, I mean, really genuinely high quality pieces of art.
We've only got a couple of minutes left. We want to talk about the music. The Art of the Radio Times is on Radio 4. That's the 26th of September at 11:30 a.m. and no doubt will be played several times. And that's pretty much the anniversary, 2 days shy of the anniversary. The music of the Radio Times, Radio 3, Wednesday the 28th of August in the evening. What's that going to feature?
Well, it feature a lot of music, actually. One of the things
I suspected it might do. I realise that the silly questions as it came out.
Well, the funny thing is that radio in those days was actually almost wall-to-wall music. I mean, there are plenty of music stations now, but actually it was a bit like a sort of early days classic FM, because there wasn't rock music, pop music in those days. It was jazz was coming in the early 20s and 30s. But actually there wasn't, the first DJ, Christopher Stone, the BBC's first DJ. I mean, he came in a DJ DJ in a dinner jacket, actually.
This is actually true, is it? I've heard this and often thought it was myth. The first broadcaster wore a dinner jacket.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful.
They did. Because they were, I mean, they were. It was a very much a smoking room atmosphere in the BBC. But going back to the music of Radio Times, there was, I mean, just acres and acres. It was a magazine, and there was acres and acres of coverage, largely of classical music, but a lot about jazz, a lot about the dance bands, the Savoy Orpheans, because it was the early BBC station was actually right down by the Savoy Hotel, and the Savoy Orpheans, the house band of the Savoy Hotel, were the BBC's own house band. Mm. So there was a lot of coverage of music and a lot of debates about is music, you know, what they talked about, highbrow versus lowbrow music. Can I end, Ian, with
Are you going to sing for us?
No.
I thought we were building up to a song.
I've got a limerick.
Is it filthy? Don't get me sacked on my second day, Simon, please.
I'm afraid not. It comes from 1930, and it's about music. And it actually, we put it in the programme because I think it's lovely. They had a limerick competition.
Yep.
In Radio Times, because it was always talking to its readers and listeners, and it was all about this fight between what they called highbrow music, i.e. classical music, and jazz, the new sweeping trend that was lowbrow. So this is what a listener wrote in, and I think it's quite funny. It goes, "I'm a listener, oh yes, and a highbrow, and that is the reason that I sigh now. For jazz is the rage in this decadent age, which elevates naught but an eyebrow."
Fantastic. Simon, very nice to meet you. Thank you so much for coming in. The two shows, Music of the Radio Times, Radio 3, Wednesday the 28th of August in the evening. The Art of the Radio Times, Radio 4, Thursday the 26th of September. And, of course, he's waving a book at me. Hello again. The 9 decades of radio voices. I'm not in it. I'd wait for the next edition, possibly, when I'll be in it. Very nice to meet you, Simon. Thank you very much for coming in. Let's have a little bit of music, shall we? This is very decadent. That's them Kinks. That's them Kinks. I'm asking, have you ever been on TV or on radio? On Twitter, Paul Murphy says, "I won the Screen Test Champion of Champions in 1984. Will that do?" Oh, will it do, Paul? So, kids these days, they've never even heard of Screen Test. It was a quiz about films, I think. That was it. Give me a call. 020-722-4-2000. Ever been on TV or on the radio? Hello, this is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9, sitting in for Robert Elms this week. We're celebrating the magic of the Radio Times. Just to go back to that news bulletin, I know lots of people have been having lots of very nasty threats and things made to them on Twitter. Have you only just realised Twitter is a vile place inhabited by horrible subhumans who like to bully people? Have you only just realised that? That's been like that for years. I've had terrible threats against me and my family on Twitter. I complain to Twitter. Oh, no, they're not doing anything wrong. Complain to the police. Oh, there's nothing we can do. Oh, it's been like that for a long time. It's a horrible place. I like to pop in every now and then, but it's a dirty, dark, horrible place. Anyway, saying that, you can follow me on Twitter, at Ian Lee. A few of you have posted today. We're looking forward, as we're celebrating the magic of the Radio Times, I want to find out, not one of those shows that necessarily talks about your favourite programmes from the 70s. Oh, do you remember kids' programmes from the 70s? Because if we do that, we'll be talking about Spangles and Space Hoppers next, and that way madness lies. But, if you've ever been on television, in whatever capacity, up until I worked on television, my proudest television moment was at the age of about 1982, so I was 9 years old. I was in the audience in the last series, in the very small audience for Swap Shop. Oh, I know. There were only about 20 kids allowed in, and they tried it as an experiment. And who was on my Swap Shop episode? Shall I tell you? Bernie Clifton and his comedy Ostrich. Not bad. Sarah Brightman. Ah, that's not bad. The Carpenters. Yeah, that's right. I saw The Carpenters. I was 6 feet away from Karen Carpenter. And for Richard Carpenter, he left because he had a migraine. They gave away an Astro Wars game. Yeah, I'm old enough to have seen The Carpenters. Doesn't that say a lot? If you've ever been on TV or radio, the more obscure, the more ridiculous, the better, then do give me a call, please. 020-722-4-2000. Or send me an email. I've got my emails open here. ian.lee@bbc.co.uk. It's Iain.lee. Maxwell's coming up soon, which is very exciting. Maxwell Hutchinson, I met him 10 years ago this very year. Will you remember? Probably not. I was probably very drunk at the time. Before that, shall we have a tune? Now, who'd have thought it? In the early 70s, when no one was buying their records, the Beach Boys released some of their finest music. I'm trying to get back into the Beach Boys again after their disappointing live album they just released, where I would say about 15% of it is actually live. The rest of it is run through a computer and sounds hideous. I'm trying to rediscover some of the joys of the Beach Boys, and one of them is this gorgeous track from Sunflower, which I think is about 1970. It would have sold probably no copies whatsoever. It was a B-side to a single. It's wonderful. Listen to these boys rock. See, I hear something like that. It's About Time by the Beach Boys from Sunflower. The best Beach Boys album, but don't tell the Pet Sounds fanboys. And I can almost forgive them for their awful excuse of an, inverted commas, live album they've just released. Oh, man. It's all run through auto-tune. And lots of it's recorded in the studio. It's crazy behaviour. Hello, this is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. We're celebrating the magic of the Radio Times. Ever been on TV? 020-722-42000. David's in Little Stanmore. Let me just do this. Hello, David.
Hello, good morning, Ian. First memories of Radio Times, I think, was going down to get it when it was 2 pence and the dandy and a bag of crisps for sixpence.
Oh.
That was back in the 40s. No, I was on television, I think. This was a series by Daniel Farson called In Pursuit of Happiness.
Yes.
It must have been about 1958. And he would go to various locations and study people's lifestyles. And so he came to the island of Lundy, which is in the Bristol Channel. It's about 3 miles by half a mile, about 1,000 acres. And I was living over there at the time, just after I'd come out of the Royal Air Force, working on the farm behind the bar.
Yeah.
And playing the harmonium in the church and the pub piano and all that sort of thing, doing everything that you do on an estate, really. Everyone, there's only about 12 of us there, I think, one winter.
How old were you when you were living on the island of Lundy?
Ah, well, I'd come out of the Air Force, so I must have been about 21 then. I'd gone out to various holidays, I suppose, there from about 1944, 45, I suppose. But at that time, you couldn't get to the island during the war, and it wasn't until afterwards. And I think it was about 1954 when I first went out on a day trip on the Campbell steamers. We used to call them shambles because there were no licensing laws. No, there were licensing laws in those days. So people.
But you just ignored them.
Pardon?
You just ignored the licensing laws, David.
Yeah, we didn't have licensing laws on Lundy, and
right.
The pub could stay open as long as anybody wanted to drink, you see.
And so you were filmed for a documentary. Did you ever see yourself in this documentary?
I don't think so.
Oh.
We did have about one television set on the island, but I never... Yes, I did. Yes, we did see it. That's right.
Have you looked for it since, David? Because all of these lovely little obscure films from the 40s, 50s and 60s, it's probably on YouTube or something now.
Well, they must be about somewhere, because he did a whole series. Are you familiar with Daniel Farson?
Do you know, it's not a name that's ringing any instant bells.
No, he was quite well known at the time, and even people today still remember him, I think.
Well, David, listen, if anyone is aware of this existence in online in a virtual form somewhere, they will give us a call, 020-722-42000. It'll exist out there somewhere, David. Go and hunt it down frantically. Now... Joined by Maxwell Hutchison. Morning. Good afternoon, Maxwell.
Well, it's just afternoon.
It's just, but...
Well, afternoon begins when I've had lunch, and it's one of the few days that I have a sandwich.
Do you know what? It's interesting you say that, because I don't think it's morning until you've had a sleep. Even if it's 7 o'clock in the morning, if you've not been to sleep...
No, it's not morning, of course not.
No, you've got...
It's just
got,
extended night.
You've got...
it's not... No. When I was young and I was a rock musician, which I was, I went to bed at all sorts of times. It was always the morning, wasn't it?
Yes, of course.
Well, yeah,
of course.
Absolutely morning.
Well, you say you were a rock musician.
Well,
sir.
I was.
What kind of rock were you playing?
Well, I was.
I'm looking at you in a very dapper pinstripe suit, and I'm trying to imagine you with an axe playing Hendrix.
Yeah,
or
well,
something.
I was sort of like that. I play a variety of instruments, as the listeners know. Play the piano and the guitar and the harmonica and the double bass and the saxophone, and I played all of these things in wild abandon when I was younger. And I still play the piano quite a lot. I play the guitar quite a lot. I think playing blues guitar, which I probably play most of all now, is quite a distinguished thing for an older man to do.
Yes.
You see, you can play blues guitar at my sitting down, can't you?
Yes.
So you don't have to sort of gad about and pretend that you're... that you're somehow youth, which I absolutely loathe to see. I mean, the Rolling Stones rushing about like they're children, and the man's 70, for goodness sake.
Well, it's embarrassing. It's like, Grandad, please sit down
now.
Do
you think it's embarrassing?
I think it's awful. I think that...
you're younger than I am. Do you think it's embarrassing?
I do think it's embarrassing. I've never been a massive fan of the Stones, but I do think they should sit down and...
Yeah, I... But, well, I think...
Or play that blues music. They're old enough to play the blues music authentically.
Of course, they started in the Railway Hotel opposite Richmond Station. That's where they started, with a couple of beaten up Vox AC30s and some second hand famous guitars, really bad guitars. And they played things like Little Red Rooster and brilliant, marvellous music.
Yep.
And then they wrote some rather silly pop songs that have endured and endured and endured. But the Railway Hotel opposite Richmond Station, please will someone tell me it's gone back to being the Railway Hotel? Because it was some sort of horrible wine bar.
Oh, didn't it become a chain or something?
I mean, you would have thought that Mick Jagger would have bought it, wouldn't you, really? I mean, apparently he's got quite a few dollars.
Well, he spent his money on the Mick Jagger Art Centre in...
Well, John Lennon has got an airport named after him, for goodness sake. Well, have you got anything named after you? What's your surname?
Lee.
There must be Lee Road.
Yes,
there's the Lee Bridge Road. Yes. And the River Lee, goodness me.
Spelled differently, but I'll take it.
Oh, yeah, I would take every bit.
I will have
some
of that.
I don't think there's a Maxwell Road or a Hutchinson.
Maxwell House Coffee. Oh, you've got a whole drink named after you.
No, I don't think it exists anymore. No, don't. But I don't think there's a road, is there? Well, you've got Lee. Yes, it's spelled differently.
Yes, you see,
that's a shame, isn't it?
That's the problem.
Oh, Robert's got... There's an Elms Road somewhere down the side of ITN building to South Grayson Road.
I was very surprised, in another life I work elsewhere, there is a Paula Radcliffe Way. And it doesn't sound right. I named after the athlete. Paula Radcliffe Way. Where do you live? Number 62 Paula Radcliffe Way.
No, it doesn't. It
there's
doesn't,
no gravitas to a name like that.
Well, there's a new short road where I lived. I live in Hoxton, just behind Old Street Roundabout. Mm. And Old Street Roundabout is now called... Silicon Roundabout.
Oh, no. When did that happen?
Well, it happened surreptitiously when everyone was asleep.
It can only happen, though, if we let it happen. Well, if we keep calling it Old Street...
No, I keep... Well, I just say Old Street Roundabout. But on the other hand, from my point of view, property prices and the energy in the area, there are more start-up. There are 14,000 new start-up... computer-based businesses round Old Street Roundabout in the last 12 months.
Are they really?
14,000 have started. And you can tell it's a 24-hour-a-day activity. Coffee shops, bars, restaurants, people meeting. It's unbelievable what has happened. But the reason for the story is there's a short length of road between new student accommodation and a hotel which is called Silicon Way. it's where you go to get it's where you go to get your implants.
Who names streets? Is there a man who is in charge of naming streets?
No, I think it's the council.
Oh, dear.
The council, the faceless animal that is the council.
Mm.
Completely faceless, completely lacking in any personality and any identity. I don't know. Why can't someone name a street after me? Ooh, someone's got to name a beer after me, apparently. I hope and I trust. It would be much more... would you like to be named after you? A ship? A railway? A steam train? A ship? A bottle of beer?
Not a ship. I don't drink, so I wouldn't want a beer particularly. I'd like a wing of a hospital. That would be nice, wouldn't it? Because it feels like by not actually doing anything, you're doing a lot of good for people. You're helping ill people.
I see. So you want all the praise, all the acclamation, without having to do anything.
None of the effort or financial investment.
At all. Yeah, so you can have a wing of a hospital.
That'd be nice.
I'm not sure I'd like that, because if it's not a very good hospital, you'll get blamed.
Oh, yeah, that's true, yes.
Yeah, under the new system of checking hospitals out. I mean, you don't go near this place, because all you want is the acclamation. You actually don't want to go and do it.
I have no interest in what happens within those walls.
No, you don't. And then it gets a bad rating in the new star rating, and then it's your fault.
Wow, you've really damned me.
No, absolutely.
What makes you think my hospital ward will be a bad hospital ward?
Well, I don't know.
It'll be a darn good one, Maxwell.
I wonder statistically whether it's going to be good or bad. What about a bus? I'd quite like to have a bus actually named after me, wouldn't you? Why can't we name buses?
You could probably sponsor buses. I, as a present, a birthday present for my wife a few years ago, I had I bought her one of the benches in Highgate Woods.
Oh, that's lovely.
You get a little plaque made.
Do you go and sit on it and be romantic?
We do go and sit on it. Not romantic. We've got two kids now, but we do go and sit on it.
Hang on a moment. Yes. Because you've got two kids doesn't mean that you...
I've worked out how those kids came about. I'm not having any of that nonsense again. But yes, we do go and sit on it sometimes. And it's difficult wording a plaque on a bench. To make it, to fill it with joy. And I was sat there, and there was an old couple sat there, and I said, oh, have you noticed the plaque? And the woman went, oh, yes, isn't it sad? She was a mother as well. And she
thought it was a memorial.
She thought it was a memorial. It was to my darling wife, lots of love forever, your husband and son. And it was something like that. And it does sound like she's dead.
Yes, it does. It does. Why couldn't you say... I can't imagine you could say anything that would be anything other than... implying that she was...
I spent a long time trying...
Even if you say, you know, I love you, dear, and so do the kids, or something like that, it would still sound like an epitaph of some sort,
wouldn't it? She's missed. She's left kids behind as well as her husband.
Oh, God.
I spent a long time trying to make it positive.
Lots of old ladies would go and sit and cry on your behalf. Yep. What did your wife say?
She was pleased when she saw it, but the novelty wore off.
As she said at least twice in your life, take it off.
Yes, she has. No, she was very upset when we got there once, and the bench had been vandalised. She got very upset.
Ooh,
and we sorted that out immediately.
How?
I phoned up the ranger. Are they called rangers in Highgate Woods? Why not? I phoned up
really Canadian.
Yes, I phoned up the park ranger, and he said, "Oh, no, don't worry, we'll sort that." He came and fixed it, cleaned it up, sorted it out. It was did a very good
job.
Where
is it?
It's in Highgate Woods. It's if you sit on it, in front of you, you've got the cricket pitch, and directly behind you, you've got the playground.
Oh, so you can go and pay homage. And by the way, it's not a memorial. It is a current token of enduring love and romance.
Have you never done anything like that? It's a nice...
No, I've never. No, I've never.
Immortality.
I'm not sure I'm interested in immortality particularly.
Really?
I think I was, but I'm not anymore. I'm not interested. My name is carved into the travertine marble in the RIBA building down the road from here.
Oh,
but I'd rather it
look at you, that trumping my plaque on a bench.
No, but I'm not actually interested. I thought we were going to talk about broadcasting.
Oh, sorry, yes. Well, there was a reason you came in, wasn't there? It wasn't just wandering to have an argument.
No.
Well, the Radio Times...
No, hang on a second. I'll just finish this for a moment. I used to think that I was interested in legacy and in what... I haven't got any children, never have.
Nope.
I've left some buildings behind, but when people ask me where they are and what they are, I never identify them.
Mm.
Because increasingly, the older I get, the least I seek any degree of immortality. I think that when I'm ceased to be mortal... I would rather it sort of finished and we done with it.
And that's it.
Yes, I'm destroying records as well. Not vinyls.
No.
Paper records. Just don't want them anymore. This is a cleansing process. I recommend it.
I have... we will talk about what you came in for a second. I have downgraded my telephone to this. I'm holding an old Nokia. All it does is it makes phone calls, it sends texts, it plays Snake. That is it.
Sorry, it plays what?
Snake. It's got the... You Snake.
What are you on about?
It's a
excuse me. What is he talking about?
Snake. It's one of the oldest phone games in the world. You have a little snake and you go and eat things. Anyway, what I'm saying is...
No, we're talking about the Radio Times.
The Radio Times. 90 years of the Radio Times.
Yes, we used to get the Radio Times when I was a kid. Kid, that's a horrible way to describe children. It's really insulting.
Yes.
When I was a child, I thought as a child.
Yep.
And now I'm a man and never, I put aside childish things.
Oh.
It's all right, 1 Corinthians 13.
I knew I recognised it from somewhere.
Yeah, it's... the Radio Times was somehow a touchstone of modernity in a world before television. It was considered to be quite something to get your Radio Times and look up all the radio stations.
I've always thought it's a little bit classier than the TV Times. The TV Times was a little bit downmarket.
Than the what?
Yes, the TV Times. You've never heard of that? The rather cheap, low-budget version of it.
No, the Radio Times, I think it's quite a superior publication of this very day. It was published from a building in Marylebone High Street.
Right.
Which this station used to occupy.
Yes, I know the building,
And it was... Oh, gosh, what was the publishing company called that did it? It began with H.
Oh, someone, do you know what? Someone sent me an email whose dad used to work there. Let's have a little look. Hang on a second. Hannah says, my dad used to work for the Radio Times in the late 70s. Many happy memories of visiting him as a child at the Marylebone High Street
office.
That's
right. I worked there for years.
Yes, in particular, the cafeteria roof garden.
That's where this station's weather used to go out from.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, Peter, the weatherman.
Peter Cockcroft.
Used to stand on the roof.
Occasionally spotting celebrities in the lifts. My brothers and I were so inspired, says Anna. My brother and I were so inspired. We used to make our own versions of the Radio Times at home. That's dedication. Above and beyond.
But what was the building called in publishing company?
She doesn't say.
Well, there was a publishing company that did the radio.
0207-224-2000, tell us.
Well, it was a very distinguished thing. I quite liked it as a child. I don't know why I did, because I think it... Well, the anticipation of listening. And I'm sufficiently old to remember things before any telly.
Yes.
So the Radio Times told us what time we could listen to The Goons and The Navy Lark and all sorts of... Marvellous.
Who was that ventriloquist dummy? Was that Archie Andrews?
Yes, it was. But the idea of a ventriloquist on radio is really wonderful,
isn't it? It's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, it's educating Archie.
Educating Archie. Yes, that's right.
Well, of course, in those days, we sat at home in the evenings. I'm an only child, and my father was an architect, and we sat at home in front of the coal fire. I know this all sounds terribly, you know, wartime, but it was just...
This happened within your lifetime.
Yes,
wow, that's
indeed.
Incredible.
Yeah, within my lifetime, wow. Yes. Can't you tell? We listened to the radio.
Yeah.
And had a great big beautiful pie, polished oak box with huge dial on it. It had all these continental stations on Hilversum and things. But because we got, you eventually got tuned in to the home service. Wouldn't it be lovely?
Wouldn't it be lovely?
Well, she's still called the Home Secretary.
I'm going to call them kids. I don't mind. As a 40-year-old man, I've earned that right. They with their mobile phones that can carry all of the radio stations in the world, they don't know that radios used to be huge bits of the furniture. We had...
Did you have one?
We had one of those, what do they call it? That big...
Radiogram.
Yes, with
a record player in the middle.
And the compendium of games down one end, and it was a huge, massive piece of furniture.
Well, if
wonderful.
You had it now, it'd be worth a lot of money, by the way.
Yeah, of course.
It's probably made by G-Plan or Ercol.
G-Plan rings a bell, actually. It could have been them.
Grange Plan is what it was, but G-Plan, I know a man that can get one for you if you want one.
I'm all right, thank you very much. Listen, let's have some music.
I've got tons of... Oh, all
right. We're going to talk to you after 1 o'clock. You don't need to shoot off, do you?
No, I'm not. I stay here till half past. You're going to put up with me for another...
We'll see what we can do, Maxwell. Stay there. This is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9, sitting in for Robert Elms. We'll have more from Maxwell Hutchinson.
BBC London 94.9.
London's news, London's stories.
Hello, this is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9, 6 minutes past one. Sitting in for Robert Elms all this week. Don't panic. I'm not messing with the formula. Maxwell Hutchinson's coming up very, very soon. We're celebrating 90 years of the Radio Times today. And I thought it'd be nice to talk about your appearances on TV or on radio. We've got some great emails coming in. I'll read those a bit later on. If you've ever been in the back of a film or you turned on the telly, have you been one of those, I'll use the word idiots, but I've wanted to do it myself. One of those idiots that when there's a news report, you've stood behind the news report on your telephone, seeing if your mum can see you. Have you done that? I kind of respect those guys. If you've ever been on TV, then give us a call, 020-722-42000. You can email ian.lee, ian.lee@bbc.co.uk. One of the great joys of being here is I'm allowed to bring in a couple of CDs myself. Well, at least that's what they say. Probably by Thursday, they'll have stopped me once they realise I'm bringing in complete guff. The next song, Michael Nesmith, from his Nevada Fighter album. It's called Nevada Fighter. Haven't opened this CD for ages. So glad I did. because in it was a CD I lost a year ago. Oh, marvellous! Here we go, a little bit of country rock with the country rock pioneer himself, Nevada Fighter by Michael Nesmith.
Oh, I love it.
Michael Nesmith of the Monkees. I put this out yesterday. He single-handedly invented country rock. And there is no debate about it. If you want an argument, I will give you that. This is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9, joined by Maxwell Hutchinson. Maxwell, you're disappointed. No one has called in.
Tell me who the publishers of Radio Times.
For goodness sakes, 0207 22 42000. We've set you a task, dear listener. Rise to it. Rise to it.
No, the Radio Times is quite a lively publication at the moment, because there's always things coming out of interviews, because I suppose when people are being interviewed by the radio, they feel it's safe, don't
yes,
they? Well,
yes.
If someone rang you up and said, we'd like to do a feature interview with you,
you'd
feel safe. I'd be like Miss Marple, wouldn't it?
You trust her until she realises that she works out you're the murderer.
Yes, yeah, but you can probably say things.
Yes.
Have you ever been in the Radio Times?
I was in there for the first time about 3 weeks ago. They do a tiny little slot, face behind the voice or something.
This is why we're talking about it today.
I insisted.
You've been in it. Yes.
When I took this gig, you have to mention my appearance in the radio. Yes, they did. And I had a lovely chat with a gentleman on the telephone, and it's a tiny little piece.
But so yes, it's a face behind the voice, is that
I think
right?
That's what they call it, yes. Mm. I've not seen it. But I found myself saying stuff to this guy, and then, I mean, nothing huge or anything, but stuff I wanted to keep private. But then saying it, and afterwards thinking, well, how did he get that out of me?
Ah, because it was Auntie BBC.
It was the Auntie Beebe.
Yes.
Why did we start calling the BBC Auntie Beebe? Why Auntie?
Well, the Auntie, because we've always thought about the BBC as rather affectionately, haven't we?
Yes.
Do we still?
Some do.
Yeah, yes, well, I suppose that comfort.
Yep.
Well, certainly I'm a great BBC listener at home on the radio, great radio listener more than I watch television, I think. And aunties were people who gave you things that you wanted.
Yes.
But you didn't know you wanted, if you know what... Yeah. And I think the BBC gives you things that you didn't know you wanted. It's programmes that you didn't anticipate, didn't plan, and suddenly they produce something for you that is like a present from a wonderful aunt. An aunt that you never meet, but an aunt who is generous and kind and thoughtful.
Sometimes,
and when you open the aunt's present, you see, it isn't what you thought it was going to be.
Yes.
And I think that's a lot of what the BBC
sometimes
does.
She sends you a jumper, though, that's too small for you.
Oh, yes, yeah.
That would be EastEnders, I would say.
Well, that's probably... But I haven't watched EastEnders. Oh. It might fit me perfectly.
Have you ever seen EastEnders?
Yes, I have. Well, I live in the East End of London, don't I? So I don't need to watch it because I live it.
Yes.
If you live in Shoreditch, I live in Hoxton, which is part of Shoreditch, then you don't need it, really. And I spend a lot of my time working in Bethnal Green. So
I
went to a marvellous wedding on Saturday.
Yes.
A real East End wedding. And the guy was a publican.
Yeah.
And he decorated the altar with hops.
Really? Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
It was great. We went on Routemaster buses to go to the reception and everything. So, you know, EastEnders, eat your heart out. Just come and spend some time with me.
Now, you've been broadcasting for
I've been broadcasting
even born,
for a very,
probably.
Very long time. When were you born?
1973.
Yes, I was broadcasting 2 years before you were born.
Wow, gosh.
It's a rather strange story, but it does bring some architecture and buildings, which is what I'm in.
That's what you've been built for, isn't it?
I don't mind. I can talk about anything you like, apparently. Some of which is entertaining, some of which isn't, some of which is relevant, and some of which isn't.
Yes.
Some of which is accurate, and most of which is.
Okay, you say most of it. Is some of it a little bit of puff and bluster?
No. I don't have to puff and bluster anymore. I'm old enough. I start... It's a story that goes like this. It's a very BBC thing to say, isn't it, really? I taught George Melly. You know who George Melly is?
Of course I know George Melly.
I taught George Melly to play the piano.
Sorry? George Melly?
I taught the George Melly to play the piano. Now, the reason is he didn't want to admit that he couldn't play the piano.
Yeah.
And I was working for an architect in Hampstead whose wife was a children's dance teacher. And she taught the Melly children, Diana's and George's children, to dance. I mean, sort of prance about, you know, like sort of Isadora Duncan style.
Yes.
And he said he wanted to learn to at least to be able to play the 12-bar blues and sing one or two standards. And I was recruited to so do. So I used to go to his marvellous house on one side of the house in Inverness Terrace, I think it is. Well, it's at the end of Inverness Market in Camden Town. Mm. George there, and on one side was Jonathan, what's his name, the theatre director.
Oh, the theatre director, Jonathan.
Dr. Jonathan Theme Bob.
Okay.
Yes. And Joan Bakewell was on the other side. And I got to know them. I went to dinner parties.
Wow.
With these people. And at the time, Diana Melly was working for Release, which was the drug rehabilitation and advice centre. And I taught him to play the piano. Amazing experience.
Was he a good learner at the piano?
Nobody really cared.
No.
We're just having a jolly good time, really. He collected Magritte.
Magritte?
The artist.
Oh, sorry, yes.
René Magritte pictures, and he knew him very well.
Right.
And he had the most fantastic collection of original Magritte.
He was a character. I read a cracking book about him.
I also did a television programme with him called Thoroughly Modern Melly.
Yes, I remember that.
I was in it. I don't know what I was doing. I was playing the piano and drinking whiskey.
I was going to say that I would have thought there was quite a lot of booze involved.
Yes,
he liked a bit of booze.
There was a lot. Anyway, he had a radio programme on the BBC World Service called... He wrote a book called Revolt into Style, which was all about the Beatles generation and how they started off kicking against the pricks, and then they became actually very established MBEs and all that. But they sent them back, didn't they? Some of them did. John Lennon.
John Lennon did, yes, because Cold Turkey was going down the charts.
Yeah, well, was that what it was?
It was. He said because of the Vietnam War and because of his single Cold Turkey going down the charts.
Well, it was... The idea was that the Beatles went from being angry young men in the sort of Rubber Soul album period to being thoroughly establishment and being welcomed at parties and so on. And the programme he hosted, I can't remember what it was called, but it was a live BBC World Service programme, which is quite unusual because it was going out, if you think about it, going out round the world at everybody else's time.
Yeah.
Miller. Jonathan Miller, it was.
Jonathan Miller, well done.
Wow, what amazing dinner parties. Imagine I'm 20 and I'm sitting with Joan Bakewell, Jonathan Miller and George Melly having supper.
Well, that must have been incredibly intimidating. Or did you just fit? You were so drunk you didn't mind.
Well, no, I wasn't particularly drunk.
You weren't drunk?
I wasn't drunk. No, I never get drunk.
No.
But I was just amazed.
Yeah.
I think I did feel a bit intimidated about joining in the conversations, particularly
very
with Jonathan Miller.
Yep.
Actually, he was, and then Joan Bakewell used to be called the Thinking Man's Crumpet.
Yes,
didn't she?
Yes, she did.
I was once introduced as an afternoon speaker as a Thinking Crumpets man. Not bad, is it?
Have you
really
mentioned buildings yet?
No, we haven't come on to that. But my broadcast. George Melly had a radio program in 1971 on the BBC World Service.
Yep.
And for some peculiar reason, I was asked to do the album review. Mm-hmm. The album being an LP review. Quite wide. I did what's the radio equivalent of screen test?
An audio reel. They would call it.
Went in and I did this test and I got past it. So. And then the first album I ever reviewed was John Lennon's Imagine.
Oh, there we
which
go.
I absolutely loathed.
Oh, shame
I
on
still
you.
Loathe it. It's both soppy nonsense and...
It's sweet and romantic. No, it's his softer side.
No, and also a working class hero is something to be.
Yes.
Multi-millionaire.
Yes, but he can still portray the roles. Anyway.
That's the view I took. I might like it if I heard it now. I don't like Imagine any more than I like Hey Jude.
The song Imagine is very silly, yes.
Yes, it's a silly song. Yes, it is a very... So, I remember going to Bush House. Have you ever broadcast at Bush House?
I'm not from Bush House,
tell you the story of Bush House. I went into Bush House, and I was introduced to my producer, who was post-colonial civil servant. Mm. So, he's wearing a double-breasted suit, as I am today, with a bow tie. And he only ever called me Hutchinson. Not Mr. Hutchinson, just Hutchinson.
Hutchinson?
Yeah, like a prep school master. He took me up to my studio. And every studio in Bush House at that time, which was where the World Service was broadcast from, was decorated in the style of some of the Empire.
Mm.
And the studio I was in was decorated in the Zulu style. So there were shields and crossed spears.
Right.
I'm not kidding.
This is incredible, yes.
Yep. And then I pre-recorded it onto tape, and I had one of those famous lozenge-shaped microphones, you know, sort of trapezoidal jobs with BBC on the top, and Bakelite headphones. Do you remember those little really uncomfortable, you probably don't?
No, I don't.
Well, the little round Bakelite headphones. They're really... John Humphreys on the Today programme still wears them.
Right, he would do, wouldn't he?
Because I do the Today programme, yeah. Well, yeah, but jolly good show. I mean, if it works, if it works, I mean, wear the headphones that suit you and work.
Just to establish, we are now on your building, aren't we?
Yeah, we're coming to the building.
Well, we've got 10 minutes left.
It's all right. No, it's plenty of time. Well, okay. Isn't it? Actually, we've got 9 minutes.
Right.
I did this programme for years.
Yes.
And I learnt how to broadcast. I remember when I talked too quickly, which, which in those days was not acceptable.
No.
He used to come on the fold-back and say, Max, well, slow down. Mm. Remember the engineer in Zagreb?
Yes.
The idea was that I was broadcasting to this engineer in Zagreb who had a valve radio tuned to the BBC World Service.
Yes.
I did a marvellous programme for the World Service, which was teaching English through talking about the history of buildings.
Buildings?
Yeah, but it was fascinating. Yes,
buildings!
We finally got
we've
to
got there, yes.
Yeah, because I remember lines in this series to teach English.
Yes.
In the English countryside, there are many cottages. A cottage, a small house for working people in the countryside.
Yeah.
So every word I said like that, you know, ah. And then we visit castles in Wales. Castles, fortified houses for kings and monarchs to protect themselves. So everything had to be defined. Anyway, Bush House. I don't know what's in it now, but it's called Bush House because it was built by an American, Mr. Irvin T. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he's got any relationship at all with recent governing Bushes, I don't know at all. And it was started in 1919, which was part of the Kingsway development, where the rookeries of St. Giles were demolished. I mean, that whole area was the most ghastly slum. And whereas we were building the empire, we were building Africa, and we were building India, and we were building all the great capital cities.
We weren't doing much here. We were leaving stuff here.
We were ignoring our own capital city and eventually became embarrassed by it. So we shipped out all the people that were living in the rookeries and put them in some quite nice housing, 1920s housing in the East End, that still works really quite well today. Cleared all that away, and then we built Kingsway and the famous Kingsway tram tunnel, which I'm sure you've been in the car through.
Many, many times.
Some of it.
Yes.
And it used to have a tube stop. It used to go down a spiral staircase, and you could get onto the horse-drawn tram underground.
Fantastic.
Well, you know where there's a blank entrance to it at the Southampton Road.
Yes.
Well, that's where the trams, the horse-drawn trams, used to come out. But you could go halfway down at the corner of Holborn and get on a horse-drawn tram underground. Isn't that wonderful?
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Bring that back.
Yeah, and then the focal point of Kingsway was Bush House, designed, you know, Mr. Bush. 1919. He employed American architects, Helm and Corbett, which couldn't have been terribly popular, really. It took a long, long time to build. It was finished in 1935.
Mm.
And it was built as a World Trade Centre. Now, I really never understood what a World Trade Centre is. I'm not sure that the famous World Trade Centre, no longer with us, was a World Trade Centre at all, was it?
No, I've never quite understood that term, because there was so much more going on in there as opposed to just trade. It was everything that was in those buildings, wasn't
it? Yes, there was. Yes.
Really?
Yes, awful to think about the fact they're no longer there.
Mm.
I remember going to a lecture at the Architectural Association where I trained about the design of the World Trade Centre, the Twin Towers.
Yes.
Famous twin towers. And when they were designing them, the orientation of the towers had to be very carefully considered because of the wind loading. Now, what they had to make sure was that when the wind blew, they both moved in the same direction.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, because they move quite a lot.
Yes.
They'll move, you know, 5 or 6 centimetres, you know, 4 or 5 inches in the wind. And if two secretaries who knew each other were sitting in opposite towers and they were moving the opposite way,
they'd be terrified.
No, because they would know they were moving. Yeah. But as long as they moved
tell.
In a synchronized way, they wouldn't know. But they were World Trade Center. So it was a ghastly mistake. Mr. Bush made a mistake. By the way, when I said it was finished in 1935, he was very superstitious.
Mm.
And he believed that no building should ever be finished. So one
what?
No building should ever be completely...
What a crazy superstition!
No. Because one of the capitals, that's the fussy bit at the top of the column, isn't finished.
Right.
And when I broadcast there, because this station was broadcast out of there for years, I went and found the one that wasn't finished to satisfy. So it was very unsuccessful, but it is a grand, grand building, marble halls, beautiful staircases. But it made a perfect radio station because it's so solidly built.
Mm.
Put the studios in the middle. They don't need light, do they, as we, you and I know?
Who needs to broadcast in light? Yeah, keep it dark and dank.
Yeah, absolutely. Cellars are a very good place to put people like you and I. And I broadcast there for a long time, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was then bought by, for some reason, the freehold was bought by the Church in Wales, and then the Post Office Pension Fund. The BBC moved in during the war in 1940, because it was a very solid building in the heart of London, and that's where the World Service went out from for years and years and years. And if you're travelling abroad to far-flung places, take a shortwave radio, listen to the World Service. It's wonderful.
Mm.
I remember listening to the chart show on Christmas Day when I was in Guatemala. I mean, you can't beat it, can you?
Fantastic.
Yeah, you can't beat it. The other thing, well, as I still got, I think, 2 minutes to talk about, Broadcasting House, now New Broadcasting House.
Yes.
Here, the BBC started broadcasting on the 14th of November, 1922. In Savoy Hill, down the back of the Savoy Hotel. I don't know where it did, and I probably ought to know. And they bought the site of the Broadcasting House, the famous building. They bought it in 1928. They demolished a very famous house that had been built between 1780 and 1783 by James Wyatt, a very, very famous architect. It was known as Wyatt House and then Foley House.
Mm.
And if you want to see what the house that was on the site of the original Broadcasting House next door to us now, a lot of the interior is in the Victoria and Albert Museum.
Okay.
So it was demolished, and they chose a European architect, G. Val Myers, to design Broadcasting House, and that's what we've got today. It was occupied on the 2nd of May, 1932. It cost £350,000, which is jolly cheap, isn't it?
So we had an American-built bush house, an Italian fellow. Why are they British people?
Well, I don't think Val Mayer is... I think he sounds Dutch to me. Doesn't Val sound Dutch?
Val could be kind of Dutchish.
I don't know why. And the BBC also bought three ice skating rinks in 1933 at Maidavale, which is the Maidavale Studios. Have you ever broadcast
that? I've been to the Maidavale Studios.
Yeah, I broadcast
there
as well. In 1960, the offices at the back, which are no longer there, were demolished. Eric Gill carved the carving over the entrance of Prospero and Ariel, and there are lots of stories about that, because he didn't wear anything under his shorts. Very badly bombed on the 15th of October 1940, when 7 people were killed. And the news was being read at 9 o'clock by Bruce Belfridge, and he kept on reading all the way through the bombs dropping.
See, I'd have been out.
I would have been there. And then, even despite the fact that the BBC Broadcasting House was a bomb site, they hung up some blankets, made a dormitory, and they carried on broadcasting.
You see that spirit?
We will keep on.
Wouldn't keep on. I'd go
and
home.
All the way through the war, people could read about it in the Radio Times.
You've tied it all up in
there
a lovely, neat bundle. Maxwell, it's so nice to see you. Thank you so much.
Nice to see you again.
Thank you for that. And we got to you. I was worried we weren't going to get to your building.
It's all right.
We were just going to hear your CV.
It's all carefully planned.
You're very, very... You've done
this
before, haven't you?
No.
You've done this once or twice. Lovely to see you. What's the weather like out there? Is it raining?
No, it was raining extremely heavily when I came in, so I'm damp.
I like
what do you
that.
Mean that light? You like it?
I'm bored of this heat now. It's too much. No. We want a good thunderstorm to clear the air.
Oh, what a killjoy you are.
Maxwell Hutchinson, lovely to see you. Thank you very much indeed. This is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. 020-722-42000 is the telephone number. We are looking for your stories of when you have appeared on television. The more obscure, the better, please. If it was something tiny and ridiculous, then do give us a call, 020-722-42000. Good afternoon, it's 1:33. Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. We're celebrating 90 years of the Radio Times. I'm asking for your TV appearances. So far, the best one is from David, who's emailed in, ian.lee@bbc.co.uk. Ian, my best TV appearance... Well, hang on a second, already there's intrigue there. Your best TV appearance, David? That means there's been more than one. But boy, oh boy, this would have to be the best. My best TV appearance was on Police 5 for Southampton. Who remembers that? Nobody. Nobody? I do. I was doing work experience at TVS, and they needed someone to model a jacket that's... Oh, my goodness. That's Sorry, I shouldn't laugh at this. This is horrible. They needed someone to model a jacket that someone who'd been stabbed had been wearing at the time of the incident. He then says, keep them peeled. Now, there's a catchphrase that doesn't get used very often. Who was the fella that did it? Shaw Taylor, wasn't it? At the end of it, he'd point with one finger to his eyes. He would waggle his finger at his eyes. Keep them peeled. Was it the two fingers? Keep them peeled. I need someone to... I can't quite remember. Can someone call up? This is what's great about doing this job. I'll ask this and one of you will call in. Can someone call up? I can't quite remember his physical catchphrase. I remember he would say, keep them peeled. But what exactly was he doing with his fingers? Shaw Taylor, 020-722-42000. Look, see, the phones start ringing. That's how good you are. It's either someone telling me what Shaw Taylor did or someone telling me to get knotted and move on and play a record. All right, I'll do that, shall I? Good afternoon, this is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. We're celebrating... I think celebrating is the right word. We're celebrating 90 years of the Radio Times. Who'd have thunk it had been around so long? I'm joined now by Shem Law, Radio Times Art Director and Deputy Editor, and Rebecca Gilmore, Exhibitions Project Manager at the Museum of London. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And Shem, you've given me this... What's this lovely little box of goodies you've given me?
Well,
here?
That is 101... iconic covers. Wowzers. From 90 years of the Radio Times.
Look at this. It's all lovely little postcards.
And they're all little postcards, and you pretty much got encapsulated history of the magazine.
Oh, look at this. I've opened it on a fantastic one, a Christmas issue with the two Ronnies and Morecambe and Wise together.
There you go.
Doesn't get more Christmassy than that.
It
really,
doesn't get more Christmassy than that. There's Frank Spencer. Fantastic. I shall have a little peruse through these. That's very kind. Thank you very much. Now, it's 90 years, and Rebecca, at the Museum of London, there is a big celebration and a big exhibition going on, isn't there? Has it started yet?
It opens on Friday.
Okay.
And people will have until the 3rd of November to come down and see it. It is free. So
right.
We urge you to come and come.
We
and
like
look.
Free things.
Free things.
Now I've
good.
Got kids, I like free things even more. And what are we going to see there? What's it going to compromise of?
Well, I mean, as you imagine, it's very hard to sum up 90 years of history. Mm. And we've tried to sort of tell the story of British broadcasting through the prism of Radio Times, which has been there sort of since the very beginning. Mm. And it is still going strong today. And so we look at the key sort of changes in the technologies behind broadcasting, family favourites from TV, and sort of key life-changing events, the outbreak of war, the Cold War, the space race, they all feature prominently in the exhibition and on the covers of Radio Times.
And it is, maybe this is being a little bit weighty saying this, but it does represent a huge chunk of social history, doesn't it, Shem? It is history I'm looking at with all of these covers. It's attitudes towards entertainment and education. It's attitudes towards advertising and publicity. It really is a remarkable thing just to look at all these different covers, isn't it, and see how it's transformed over the years.
It is, and it's very strange that it's a magazine that nearly didn't happen. I mean, it was launched in a fit of pique because you had Lord Reith, God bless his soul, founder of the BBC, went round to all the press barons and said, come on, I've got this new thing, and it's going to have music, and it's going to have people talking about things. And then they looked down at it and said, ah, yes, but you've got news bulletins, and we do news, so we're not going to run your listings. So in the end, he had to launch it himself, and it became the biggest magazine of British history. I mean, there's one cover in there from, I think, 1988, which is the biggest selling magazine in Britain, 11 million copies. So
wow.
It's quite a hefty thing, really.
It certainly is.
In this digital age, when people don't really buy magazines very often, to hear 11 million for a magazine is a staggering amount, isn't it?
Well, it is, and you have to bear in mind that it's the same with television. I mean, you know, the Morecambe Wise show used to get many, many more millions watching that, and now programmes struggle a bit with that because you've got so much choice. But I think that's one of the things that Radio Times sort of really encompassing so much is that people have so much choice, it's very hard to know what to watch. And for people like yourself with kids and myself, we find ourselves in on a Friday and Saturday night,
perhaps
we normally wouldn't be.
Yes.
And it's good to know that if you're going to watch something, it's something that you think is going to be good. So in that respect, I'm amazed that we still sell many, many, many thousands of copies.
And even if people don't get the Radio Times throughout the year, They always get the Christmas special, don't they? The 2 week Christmas special. Maybe it's not quite as exciting as it used to be when I was younger, but that was because everything is hyped up and advertised, you know, to the nth degree. But when I was younger, the Christmas special, it was exciting because you didn't know what films were going to be on Christmas Day and Boxing Day. You didn't know what specials were going to happen, and it was a real adventure. And it still is now. Is I nearly said it's the Bible for Christmas, but of course that's the Bible. But it is. It really is an important part of everyone's Christmas, isn't it? The Christmas special.
It certainly is. I mean, we have that in the exhibition. The magazine that Shem's talking about, we've got that issue that gets into the Guinness Book of Records. It sells so many, but we've got one of clips from I think one of the most sort of famous shows that come on is EastEnders. Yep. You know, everyone looks forward to the EastEnders Christmas special. They've gone perhaps
it's
a bit
so miserable. So who's going to die and get locked in a box this year?
But I think that probably one of the most famous thing, if you're asked to name a Christmas special, is the Den and Angie divorce scene, and yep. We've got AV points sort of featuring sort of clips from shows throughout the ages. And that's made it in there. I mean, that achieves, I think, over 30 million people watching, which is pretty much nearly all the country watching this show.
See, people consider it good now if you get 2 million for a TV programme. They think that that's a success. 5 million. Oh, my goodness. Yes, wow. But the people, you know, we would regularly on it. I'm such an old fart now. I miss the three channels when it was the three channels because you were forced pretty much to watch the same thing. If you watched Juliet Bravo on a Saturday night at 8 o'clock, you guarantee most other people would have seen that and you could talk about it. That sense of community around television has gone now, hasn't it?
Well, it's possibly, I would say, maybe moved on online, and I think that's sort of the other side of it. We now live in the digital age and you can access media from a wider variety of sources, but I think there's still that very healthy consumption of TV shows. I think you look at the rise of the big scale dramas, especially those coming over from the US over the last decade. I think people are still keen to consume this type of media.
Shem, Radio Times art director and deputy editor, it sounds very responsible, is it? What exactly does that entail?
Well, it entails doing 51 covers a year. I mean, if you were interviewing the art director of Vogue or the art director of, another monthly magazine, they only have to do 12 a year. We have to do 51. And that usually involves spending most of your week in, photographic studios around London with celebrities, the great and the good of television and radio. So it is a very responsible job. It's also probably the best job someone can have in this business. So, it is great fun. I'm quite surprised that you had three channels, though, because we only had two, because if you got the Radio Times, you weren't allowed to watch our TV.
Do you know what? There was that. As I've said before, my dad used to work at the BBC in the 70s and 80s. He worked in the props department. And for a long time, we weren't allowed to watch quite a lot of ITV. Certainly wasn't allowed to watch Tis Was, because that was seen as very common and down market, and we had aspirations to be middle class in our family, so we were not allowed to watch Tis Was, and wasn't allowed to watch Game for a Laugh as well.
That's quite astonishing.
That was considered quite subversive. Man alive, I'm so old. Shem, how long have you worked there for?
I've worked there since 2001.
Okay, well, you've been there for a while.
So though. I have been there a long time. My deputy has been there since 1985. So it's a sort of magazine where people stick around, because the great thing is that it's the magazine's about television, and television is, of course, and radio, and it's about everything. So it keeps your interest. I have worked on fashion magazines, and when you're doing a story about lipstick for the third time that year, it starts getting a little bit boring.
And TV does it, and radio, it keeps evolving. It's constantly different. What's your favourite cover that you've worked on?
My favourite cover that I worked on was when we took Sir David Attenborough. He was just David Attenborough in those days.
Just good old Dave.
Dave,
come on, Dave, put the kettle on.
To a North Sea diver's tank off the M25 in Hertfordshire, and made him stand in this freezing cold water in a powder blue safari suit that we found in a 1970 shop that was sort of ex stock for his Blue Planet programme.
Wonderful.
And it was just a terrific afternoon. He was one of the divers he worked with on some programme. And he was just fantastic with everyone. And that's a great privilege of my job, meeting people like him.
And the cover, it maybe has lost a little bit of its weight that it had in the 50s, 60s and 70s. I remember it was a big news thing sometimes as to who was going to appear on the cover. How do you decide what the cover's going to be? Is it necessarily just that the biggest programme that week? What criteria does it have to meet?
It has to be the fact that it's the biggest programme, that one of the biggest programmes that week, that the people in it are easily recognisable. Mm. I mean, unfortunately, celebrity is still really the only game in town, and so you do need people on the cover who people are going to recognise. But we've had programmes from BBC Four, we've had programmes from satellite channels on the cover if we felt that that is the biggest programme that week. Now, there's a sort of huge group of people at Radio Times who make these decisions, as well as myself, and so it's not something that's taken lightly. Back in the 50s and 60s, I believe, I wasn't around at the time, those decisions were pretty much made by the producers of the programmes who said, I want this programme on, and they'd lobby the editor and browbeat him and demand and what have you. And so there was a lot of that used to go on in the 50s and 60s.
Ever had to pull a cover?
Have we ever had to
I was kind of looking at Radio Times online before I came on, and there was a revelation that 63, is that when Doctor Who started, that there was going to be a Doctor Who Radio Times cover, but the head of the BBC at the time didn't have faith in it, and he said, no, get rid of that, put something more familiar on, and Doctor Who fans, in their infinite wisdom, were furious at this slight that was made, you know, that many years ago. Have you ever had to pull anything or change something at the last minute?
We've had to change one or two things at the last minute, but never actually had to pull. There was an instance, I have to say, in the 1970s where I think it was Bernard Levin, they decided to commission Luck and Floor, who used to make models.
Be careful how you say that. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Who made caricatures of people that went on to make Spitting Image.
Yeah.
And they'd made this rather unflattering caricature of Bernard Levin. He got to see it before it went to press, and he demanded that it was removed. And so I think those covers actually had to be pulped. But that's the only instance I can think of. No, we tried to get it right. It's very expensive if you have to pull a cover.
I can imagine. Rebecca, I would the thought, for some reason, the image that springs to mind when I think of Radio Times covers is Doctor Who, but mainly because I used to be, not so much now, I used to be a huge Doctor Who fan. Is there an element of Doctor Who in this exhibition?
There certainly is, and it's interesting you mentioned that letter about sort of the producers of Doctor Who sort of lobbying to have the show put on the cover when it's launched in the early 60s, and it doesn't make it then. It's now gone on to be the programme most featured on
it is the most
covers.
Featured. I thought so. I didn't want to say that in case you went, well, no, of course it's not, you idiot. But okay, good. I'm glad you've backed that up.
And so that relationship goes right back to the programme's inception. This year, of course, it's marking its 50th anniversary, the same year the Radio Times reaches 90. And so we have a sort of a subsection within the exhibition that explores Doctor Who, and particularly the Daleks. They feature very prominently, and they're one of the most iconic sort of baddies, I would say, of all time. And they did a lot of filming on location in London. There's a serial in the mid 60s where the Daleks come and invade London, and the humans have to fight back, led by the Doctor. And so we focus on that, but most excitingly, I'm very excited by it, we have a real Dalek coming to the museum.
Yes!
Which is
even at 40, I get excited. When I say my dad works in the props, and he's dead now, so I can say this, as there'll be very few repercussions. He, when I was 5 years old, we lived in an estate in Slough, and we had a little lock-up garage. He said, right, you and your sister, come to the garage, I've got something to show you. Yeah, Dad, or whatever. Blah, blah, blah. He opened the garage door, he'd nicked a Dalek for the weekend. We had a Dalek in our garage. Very, very naughty, but wonderful.
One of the most popular kids around.
We spent the weekend on an estate in Slough. God, he would have got so much trouble. A weekend on an estate in Slough, being sat in a Dalek and pushed around by my dad. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. Shem, how do you get the gig as being in charge of the front of the Radio Times? Because I imagine it is, in publishing and editing terms, it's got to be up there as one of the dream ones, hasn't it?
Absolutely. It really doesn't get any better than that. I don't know.
You just wandered into it one day.
It's most art directors you ever speak to ended up doing this for a living when they had a very clear idea that they wanted to do something very, very different. But you said you had a father worked in the BBC. I had a father who worked in publishing. So it became quite apparent, because both of my parents were illustrators. They both worked for the Radio Times, strangely, in the 70s. And I decided...
See, there we go. That's interesting.
You see,
yes.
And I decided at a very early age that I didn't want to be the person that was being phoned up to do work for the Radio Times. I wanted to be the person on the other end of the phone saying, can you please do this for me? Because it seemed a much more secure lifestyle.
And when I'm assuming you go on some of these photo shoots with the celebrity stuff, and are they excited to be on the Radio Times? Does it feel slightly different from your average promotional photo shoot?
It is, because it is something most of them want to send a copy home to their parents to say. And a lot of them will say, I didn't really think that I'd made it until I was on the cover of the Radio Times and my parents actually thought, yes, this is a proper job now. A lot of them play it very cool. You know, that you don't see them going around sort of fist pumping and getting very excited about it. They play it very cool and very professional. But no, one or two of them have turned around and said, this is just the best day of my life. So
there is the song Dr. Hook, the band in the 70s, recorded cover of the Rolling Stone. And then when they released it over here, they recorded a song cover of the Radio Times. They re-recorded it to fit. So it does have a bit of a cachet. So, Rebecca, just tell us a bit more about this exhibition. It starts on August the 2nd.
That's right.
Which is my wife's birthday, he says, writing down must-buy presents. And how long is it going to run for?
It runs until the 3rd of November.
Oh, OK, so it's on for a while. And how many items have you got on display?
Oh, that's a good question.
Oh, I want an exact answer and I will hold you to it.
You have to come around and count and challenge me. We have a mixture of items on show. So we've got original artefacts, our biggest being the Dalek down. Yep. And we've also got things like old radios, the original sort of valve radios.
Lovely.
Original artwork, which is fantastic to look at, to see how an illustrator sort of comes from, you know, with a concept and works that up into the finished cover. And we have sort of photographs, capturing sort of moments in recording. And I think that's particularly interesting when it's the very earliest radio broadcasts, which, you know, don't survive in their original form. So it's quite nice that someone was in there sort of shooting the actors and performers as they were recording.
And have you two been working closely together on this? Or has Shem just sent you a load of old pictures and said, go on, sort that out, you're on your own? Has he been involved?
No, it's a very much a joint venture.
Absolutely. And one of the great things we found, the Museum of London have an original Luftwaffe map with targets of London sort of circled on it, and one of them is the print works of Radio Times with "This must be destroyed."
Really? Yes. The Nazis wanted to take it down.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't just the TV Times that wanted rid of it, it was the Nazis. Look, I've just found the Only Fools and Horses Christmas special. Can I blaspheme here? Only Fools and Horses is not funny. I know it's old.
Oh, now you see, if I put that in the Radio Times, we'd get a post bag the size of
It's not funny. It's one of the most over... Oh, you plonker, Rodney. Okay, we get the idea. I'm not a fan at all. Anyway, look, I'm going to get in trouble for that now. Yeah. I won't be asked back here. Listen, the exhibition, it starts on Friday, August the 2nd. It's at the Museum of London. Cover story, Radio Times at 90. That's the title, isn't it? It's got Shem Law, Radio Times art director, Rebecca Gilmore, exhibitions project manager. Thank you very much for coming in. Best of luck with that. I'm sure it'll be a huge success. We're talking about, have you ever been on TV? Because we're celebrating 90 years of the Radio Times. Ian Hambling is cheating. This is outrageous. This is another BBC scandal set to explode. Don't let the Ofcom or the Daily Mail hear about this. We'll be in terrible trouble. Ian says, I may just claim a record. I've appeared on the BBC Antiques Roadshow no less than four times since 1996 and twice with the same teapot. What? Why? Why would you go on twice with the same teapot, Ian? Shame on you, I'm telling. Right.
BBC London 94.9.
London's news. London's stories.
Good afternoon. This is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9, filling in for Robert Elms. Just for a week. He's back next week. Don't panic. I'm looking out of the window, and boy, oh boy, it looks grey and miserable and wet and wonderful. Oh, I love it, I love it, I love it. The rain last night, did you hear it? What was great about the rain? I was in bed very, very early. I was in bed 8:30. Yeah, I know, yeah, well, yes, I know. And I could hear the rain from about 1/2 mile away. You could just hear it in the distance getting louder as it came towards me, and then it hit my roof. Oh, it was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Enough of this sunshine. Enough of all this sunshine, please. I'm bored. Lots coming up in the last hour of the show at 2:30, joined by John Terrell, who's got a new album, The Kingmaker. You might know him as half of the band Smooth and Terrell. He's going to come in and sing a song for us live. He's got a good voice. He's another one of those people that's got a really good voice. I don't like people with good voices. It makes me feel, well, insecure and insignificant. And oh, dear. But between now and then, as we're celebrating 90 years of the Radio Times, I want to know your appearances on television and radio. The smaller, the more obscure, the better. I said I was in the audience for Swap Shop. I'm also in the audience, and I got this tape back a few years ago and lost it. I was in the audience of Cracker Jack.
Cracker Jack!
Yes. I was sat one seat away from Keith Harris and Cuddles the Monkey. One of the worst nights of my life. I was about 10, and the lad behind me kept punching me in the ear. And these people think they're having a hard time on Twitter. Someone found it and sent me that tape, and I lost it. Hey, what have you been on? 020-722-42000. And also, at the end of Police 5, when Shaw Taylor did the keep and peeled, he did something with his hands. Was it just pointing at his finger? What did he do? For those of you who don't know, Police 5 was the precursor to Crime Watch. And boy, so I'd like to say, a little bit better. 020-722-42000. You can email ian.lee@bbc.co.uk or send us a text, 81333. Start your text with London. Right, enough of me talking. Should we have a little bit of music? How's your French these days? Any good?
Oh, Champs-Élysées.
Joe Dassin. What film? There's in a film, isn't it? It's, oh, what film is that from? Which is why I heard it first of all and then bought his greatest hits. Oh, someone tell me, 020-722-42000. My brain really isn't thinking at all. I like songs in French. I like songs in foreign, because then the lyrics don't become... They become less important, don't they? Quite often, a really good song will have a great tune, but you'll just think, oh, these lyrics are a bit embarrassing. I Am, I Said by Neil Diamond. Wonderful, powerful song, until you get to the line, I am, I said, to no one there, and no one heard at all. Not even the chair. Terrible line. And it ruins what should be a marvellous song. But if songs are in foreign, then the voice, well, it just becomes an instrument, doesn't it? All contextual meaning is removed from what's being said. French pop, Japanese pop is a joy. And German rap. Those three, I think, are my favourite foreign languages for music. 0207 22 4 2000. What TV programmes have you been on? Celebrating 90 years of the Radio Times, and we're asking, what have you been on? The smaller your role, the more obscure, the better, I would suggest. Let's go to Steve. Steve's in Gants Hill. Hello, Steve.
Hello there, Ian.
What have you been on, Steve?
This might not be too obscure now that you've put it in that category.
Go on.
I once appeared on the Identity Parade on Never Mind the Buzzcocks.
Oh, no, sir, that is perfect. We'll allow that. You're straight to the front of the line. Who were you supposed to be?
Well, my brother was in a band.
Yeah.
And he got the dreaded letter once from the BBC asking him to appear on the Identity Parade.
What, as himself?
Sorry?
As himself?
Oh, as himself, yeah.
So he basically got a letter saying, hey, you used to be slightly famous years and years ago. Can we laugh at you, please?
Yes. And so he didn't want to appear on it because he said, once you appear on that, that means your career's over.
Yeah.
So we were all in the pub one Saturday afternoon, and I was ribbing him and everything in front of a load of blokes. And I said, what about this miserable so-and-so? I said, he's been asked to appear on Never Mind the Buzzcocks and won't go on there. I said, you think he'd at least go on there and get his brother on telly with him? So about 3 weeks later, the phone went, and he went, you know what you wanted to do? He said, well, you've got to be at the White City BBC on Monday to so-and-so.
Oh, he did it for you, Steve.
He sorted me out.
He made a mockery of his career just to give his brother an afternoon's entertainment.
Yeah, it wasn't. It took a whole evening. You stand behind that curtain for ages waiting to go on stage.
And did you all get a bit of a ribbing? They're very cruel on that show. I've turned down going on that show because, even you know, listen, I've got a bit of a tongue on me, but even I couldn't face that tongue lashing.
It was Mark Lamar's day.
Oh, yeah, Mark Lamar, yes.
And he puts you in what order he wants. And he took one look at me, and I've always had long hair. He took one look at me, and he put me right at the end of the parade. And because I don't know if I should mention the band, should I?
We're getting to... that's definitely going to be a question in this conversation.
Oh, right. Well, the band was Secret Affair.
Who?
C-
Secret Affair.
Oh, look, you carry on talking. It doesn't ring any bells. I'm going to Google it. What was the hit?
Not Time for Action and My World.
Oh, look, maybe I'm just a little bit too young for that.
The person in question has been on the Robert Elm Show quite a lot.
Robert, listen, Robert's knowledge of music is much better than mine. He's a walking encyclopedia, that man.
Well, anyway, because the band was called Secret Affair, all Mark Lamar's handles for everyone on the parade had the word secret in it. And he put me right at the end, and he was kidding himself laughing. He said, right, you're secret lemonade drinker.
That is quite a nice little line, isn't it?
So, of course, they went along with all this, and, Phil Jukes was calling me some mobile DJ fellow or whatever. And the bloke on the panel as well was out of Terrorvision. If you remember the song Tequila.
I remember Terrorvision, yes.
Yeah, well, the bloke out of Terrorvision was on there, and he actually thought I was the person in question, which wasn't on the bad front, really, being his brother.
Did you... You don't have to answer this if you don't want, Steve, but you're a man enough. I hope you will. Did you get paid for doing that?
Yes.
What do you get?
Well, in those days, I don't think it was the turn of the century. I think it was the late 90s.
Yeah.
And I just went because I wanted to be on telly, of course.
Yeah, of course.
At the end of it, I would have got sent a cheque for £65. I was so pleased.
£65? And have you still got that on tape, Steve? Does that come out every Christmas?
Yeah, unfortunately, as you say, it's on tape.
Yeah,
convert it over to DVD.
Well, Steve, you're going to have to do that. Listen, the line's not great. I'll let you go. Stephen Gantz. Secret Affair. Now, listen, I do like a lot of music. I know a lot about certain types of music. There is no way I'm going to claim to have the same encyclopedic knowledge that Mr. Elms does. That man is a walking oral history of music. But Secret Affair doesn't ring a bell. My sister will be at home listening going, oh, for goodness sakes, Ian, you don't know Secret Affair? You don't know who they are? 020-722-42000. Alan's in Lewisham. Hello, Alan.
Hello.
Hello, Alan. What have you been on?
Well, I was on your show.
Oh, gosh. Which one? Not the 11 o'clock show?
Yep.
Oh, were you?
Only very briefly.
Last time I met someone who'd been on the 11 o'clock show, I was having an injection in my bum, and just as the needle was about to go in, the nurse went, yeah, you had me on my show a few years ago, and you were really rude about me. Oh, for goodness sakes. Was I rude about you, Alan?
Well, no, the thing is, I wasn't. I was only very briefly a star.
Okay.
I used to do a thing called, I think it was, why don't famous people go to normal people's weddings?
I vaguely remember that the campaign was to get, wasn't it to send Tommy Vance to someone's wedding?
And I was by Tommy Vance. Being the DJ, I was a mobile DJ.
At the wedding?
At that wedding, yes.
Did you get to talk to Tommy?
Yes.
God rest his soul. Wasn't he one of the nicest blokes ever?
I know, he was brilliant. He was really, really funny and he was chatty.
I remember seeing him years... I remember at the start of the 11 o'clock show, for those who don't know, it was a very foul-mouthed comedy show on Channel 4 about 12, 13, 14 years ago. Tommy Vance was on there. And I remember seeing him swanning around the office in the dark shades and the leather jacket. I thought, what a plonker. And then you get talking to him. He was the nicest, most generous bloke. Proper old school DJ voice, but what a charming gentleman.
Well, many of the copied voice. I've noticed, like, adverts and things copy his voice now.
Oh, of course they do.
They do. He had a brilliant voice. But when I was there, Isla Sinclair was there. Eddie the Edward Eagles.
Yes, I remember this. Yes, that was the level of our comedy back then. Alan in Lewisham, thank you very much. Bringing back some lovely memories. I got criticised the other day because, for those who don't remember, the 11 o'clock show, it was a thrice-weekly topical comedy show on Channel 4. And it launched the careers of some of the biggest stars in the world. Dom Jolly, Charlie Brooker, Mackenzie Crook, and, of course, Ricky Gervais and Sacha Baron Cohen. The latter two, you know, two of the biggest comedy stars in the world. And someone criticised me the other day. Said, oh, look at you. Your career never took... What a failure. Your career never took off like Gervais's and Sacha's. Hang on a second. How could I consider myself a failure for having worked with two of the biggest stars in the world? Oh, if that's failure, I consider that an overall success. 020-722-42000. What TV shows have you appeared on? And also, I mentioned this just before 2 o'clock, and I put this out there. We're talking about the Radio Times, and I've very kindly been given 101 classic covers of the Radio Times in this lovely little box, all postcards. And one of them is a Christmas cover featuring the stars of Only Fools and Horses. Now, Blasphemy of blasphemies. Am I the only person that doesn't get Fools and Horses? I don't think. The only bit I like is the bloke who calls Rodney Dave. That's the only gag I like in Fools and Horses. Am I speaking out of turn here when I say it's not just a little bit overrated, it's quite considerably overrated, isn't it? 0207224000. Don't get me started on Fawlty Towers, it's just a tall man shouting. Jerry's in Ashford. Good afternoon, Jerry.
Good afternoon, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. I'm enjoying this week, sitting in for Robert. Everyone's been very kind to me. Have you been on TV then, Jerry?
Yeah, about 8 or 9 times.
Oh, look at you, you seasoned old pro. What have you been on?
I was in episodes of Bergerac.
In Bergerac?
Yeah, I used to be a copper in Jersey.
Yeah.
And every policeman you see in that programme were real policemen they used.
Were they?
Yeah.
Because I would assume they just would have used extras.
No, real policemen, because we wouldn't let them drive our cars and that sort of thing, you see.
Right, I see. And without being disrespectful, I suppose there weren't that many crimes on Jersey, were there?
Oh, yeah, we've committed loads.
you were doing it all. So you got... Yeah. And could you see yourself in Bergerac?
I saw some of the episodes, but being on shift work, I've missed a lot of them, but... Somebody said there's a box set out there and I might get it for my Christmas.
Oh, listen, you've got to treat yourself, Jerry. Because how long ago was Bergerac? 20 years?
It was back in the early 80s.
Oh,
back
blimey.
In the 80s.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? You get to... I don't know if you've got wife or kids or anything, but have your family have probably never seen these then?
I don't think my kids have. No, my kids were only just born then. But I was in quite a few close-up frames with John Nettles because he's only... My height, I'm only 5'8".
Is he tiny?
He's about my height. He didn't like appearing in the same shot as tall policemen. Every time I was a policeman in a shot with him, there's always me got picked.
Get tiny Jerry. Quick, we want the short fella. Get Jerry over next to him.
Well, my nickname in the force was Porg.
Porg?
Yeah, person of restricted...
Oh, bless you. Bless you. Listen, Jerry, you've got to treat yourself to that box set and bore the children with it.
Well, I'll see if the kids buy it for me.
Do you? Well, it's out there. Jerry, thank you very much. That's just reminded me. Years ago, I was in 2 episodes of Spender. Do you remember Spender with Jimmy Nail? Whatever happened... I'm going to ask a question that may sound callous and cruel. I don't mean it to be. Is Jimmy Nail dead? Is Jimmy Nail still around? 0207-224-2000. Anyway, I was in Spender. I was 18. I just passed... No, I was 17. It was the year that Freddie Mercury died. It was the weekend that Freddie Mercury died. And I got to go up to Newcastle and dress up as a policeman and drive a police car. £45. Thank you very much indeed. 0207-224-2000. Fools and Horses. It's a little bit overrated. Ever appeared on TV? And also... Jimmy Nail, I don't mean any disrespect, but is he no longer with us? He has not done anything for a long, long time, has he? This is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9, sitting in for Robert Elms. You've been very generous with your phone calls and your emails and your bits and pieces. I've dared to be rude about Only Fools and Horses, and someone is obviously so offended they've created an email address just to abuse me. So they've not really abused me, they've just, their email address is plonker1936. Or maybe they haven't created that just to abuse me. Anyway, they've sent me a blank email, which I assume means that they're not happy with my criticism. I've never got Fools and Horses. It's always been one of those things. And people will say, oh, but have you seen the bit where he falls through the bar? Yes. A man falls through a bar. Okay. Have you seen the one where they're cleaning the chandeliers? Yes. You can see that they're going to drop a chandelier. That's been set up... I just find it very dull and very tedious. Hey, who am I to criticise? I was in a sitcom called The Persuasionists that, after its second episode, was moved to Sunday mornings, 2 o'clock. So, listen, I've been in pretty poor shows, but I've just never got it. 0207-224-2000, and I will say it, Fools and Horses, the Fawlty Towers as well. It's just a tall man running around and shouting. A little bit of casual racism thrown in there. It doesn't really do anything. Peter Stevens. Oh, Peter says, he's emailed in about this. I appreciate you filling in for Robert. Do agree sometimes about episodes of Fools and Horses, although to run for as long as it did, the quality did remain very high. Then he gets angry. I cannot agree at all about Fawlty Towers. There were 12 episodes of the most perfectly crafted situation comedy ever written, a work of genius from John Cleese and Connie Booth. He then goes on to say, Spender was a great series, and Jimmy Nail is still alive. And David Hughes has emailed in, ian.lee@bbc.co.uk. According to Google, Jimmy Nail will feature on Sting's next album. Huh? King of Ships. Apparently, Jimmy sent her fan letter to Elvis Presley just before Presley's sad drug and fast food caused death in August 77. Oh, I've been tricked into starting to read a joke. I have to finish it now. Oh, David. When it arrived at Graceland's, Elvis had just died. There was no point in the staff opening the letter, so they decided to send it back to Newcastle, marked Return to Spender. Oh, David. Can you believe I was suckered into falling for that? Shame on me. If you want to send me an email, that's not a terrible joke, ian.lee@bbc.co.uk. Give us a call as well, 020-722-42000. Here till, where am I here till? 3 o'clock. Coming up in the next 30 minutes of the show, joined by John Terrell, who's releasing his debut solo album, The Kingmaker. He's got a good voice. He's got a really good voice. And when you hear people like that, when I hear people like that, I become insanely jealous. It's not fair. I've been blessed with a voice that's like a cow singing in a bucket. This is Ian Lee, BBC London 94.9. You carry on, fellas. Look, John's turned up. He's brought some, I'm assuming this is the band, not just some...
No, just two fellas.
Just two fellas. You tune up. We've got a piano, we've got a double bass. You get ready. We'll be with you in a second. 0207224 2000. We'll be joined by John Terrell and just two fellas playing some instruments in a bit. Let me play a song, give you a couple of minutes to tune up, and we'll be with you in a second. Afternoon, this is Ian Lee, BBC. Where are we? For goodness sakes, I nearly said the wrong radio station. That would have been awful, wouldn't it? BBC London 94.9. Sitting in for Robert Elms here until 3 o'clock. Join now. But John Terrell, am I getting the emphasis right there? Terrell?
It can be Turrell. My dad changed it a long time ago to suit his needs. And which he found is, me, Mam. And
which is the posh version?
I think Turrell down south, but Terrell up north is a
see,
bit
Terrell sounds a bit, that sounds a bit French, but continental.
A bit more Italian if I put an E on the end as well. Terrelli.
You see, that sounds nice. Now, you're a singer.
I am.
You're a good singer as well.
Thanks.
You have a deceptive voice. Your voice is excellent. Now, this isn't to be rude about you. It doesn't go with your face, though.
It doesn't.
Have people said that before?
Well, this sort of...
they thought it would not
been
so rude.
I don't know what kind of face I've got. The kind of moon brow that I have and tiny eyes and a small pug nose.
No, not at all.
And a double
look,
chin.
That's not what I'm saying at all. You're a good-looking bloke, but your
thanks,
voice...
man.
I'll stop this line of questioning.
I'm from Newcastle. I can lend you a Maynard's hat if you want one, just to dig your way out of this one.
I am going to back away from that. And listen, you are half... You are still half of...
Still half of Smooth and Terrell. I think I will be till the day I die. They're my best mates in the world. So,
but you've got you're doing a solo record. That normally implies there's a little bit of tension or disagreement.
Not
at least
Smooth takes a lot of time to get samples and ideas and stuff together. And to be honest, I've got to keep working all the time, or else
he's
drive
doing all
myself
the,
insane.
He's doing all the production, all the sample, all the computery bits and pieces.
Yeah.
And that can be a little bit tedious, can't
a little
it?
Bit tedious. So I back off, and then I've been working with a guy from London called Nick Faber.
Okay.
Who's been great. It's been a breath of fresh air, you know.
Yeah.
Something different from what I was doing. It was pointless doing another thing that sounded exactly like Smooth and Terrell.
Yeah.
So I've went back to my roots. I came from singer-songwriter kind of blues area of vocal. And I've ended up a soul singer with Smooth and Terrell through no fault of my own. But I just wanted to do something that was more a little bit more me. So that's
so what you say singer, you came from the singer-songwriter blues kind of thing. What were you listening to as a kid then?
Nick Drake, Joni Mitchell. To be honest, I always had a really good kind of upbringing with music. And it wasn't all, you know, I was listening to The Cream, Led Zeppelin. You know, I was a bit of a rocker at school because it's the only way you could be in a band, you know. Andrew Champion will vouch for that. This is my bassist.
This is your bass player. Hello, Andrew. You're right.
I was in my first ever band with this guy when I was 11.
Yeah.
So, He can vouch for it.
So you've got Andrew in the base. Who's the fella you got over here with the Clint Boone?
Mike Porter.
Clint Boone's better than Anne Whittingham.
So, Anne of Cleves. We'll have Anne of Cleves here on the...
Richard III, I've been dug up in a...
No, Clint Boone's a great one. I'm a big fan of Clint. He's one of the greatest keyboardists of all time.
He's very good friends with
Mike.
He's
one of my best friends.
He's a good... Say hello to me. He's a good lad, Clint. Yeah. I've not seen him for years and years. He was very kind to me once. Yeah. So, John, you got your new album out, The Kingmaker. The Kingmaker. Why? Where has this come from? What's the idea behind it?
I think at the time it was the big scandal with the newspapers and who was bugging who, and eventually to have, you know, the Kingmaker who does, you know, with a lot of help, put people in power, like, you know, the government that's in today and the Labour government before them, was all due to the Sun and the, you know, whatever newspaper, the
Times.
It's
a political album, sounds
it's sort,
like,
it's sort of political, but you. It's sort of about love. It's about the time that I've spent since that big scandal happened. You know, it's 2 years in the life of me, basically.
Shall we have a listen? We've got the single. The single is Wrong Time. Have I got that right?
It's Wrong Time, yeah.
Wrong Time. Shall we have a listen to that? And then you're going to play us a song live as well.
Yes.
Which I'm very excited. And I heard you tuning up. I'm excited.
Hey, if we sound good tuning up, we're going to be amazing.
This is the single. This is John Terrell. This is Wrong Time. Let's have a little listen to this. If I can just find out which button I'm pressing. Ah, it's this one. We're on the radio. This is exciting, isn't it? We've just been doing what I... Well, I feel a little bit like Phil Spector. No, maybe not him. Brian Wilson. In that we've just been a little sound check in the band, getting everybody into the right places, moving things forward, creating the perfect wall of sound.
It's the ambiance. It's beautiful.
The ambiance. We should be lighting... You probably can't do this at the BBC. We should be lighting joss sticks and...
hey, why not?
And dimming the lights down and sitting on the floor in our pants. You up for that, lads?
Oh, we're not already?
We can be. Listen, it's a cracking sound. Now, so let's just explain the setup that we've got here. You've got double bass, you've got the pianola, you've got your voice. Are you touring this? Is this the kind of band that you're taking, or do you have a bigger band?
No, we'll have a bigger band, a five-piece band with a guitarist and a drummer. But it's ideal that we can drop down to this for... Yeah. For the likes of...
These are your two favourites in the band, obviously. The drummer...
I could never say that.
But...
I could never say that.
He's winking.
I could easily say that. I hardly know the drummer. Tarek, I'm sorry, mate, you know.
The thing about drummers is, and no disrespect to drummers, but a little bit of disrespect to drummers, they're a little bit cocky, aren't they? Because they know... drummers are really hard to find. There aren't many. So they turn up late. They might not turn up for a rehearsal. They know that you need them.
Oh, yeah, well, they're the beat makers. We can only sing on top of the beat.
Well, if the Beatmakers weren't a band in 1965, man, they should have been. It's a cracking name for a band. Okay, listen, so you're going to play for us live. What have you got for us now? What are you going to sing for us, John?
This song, originally I wrote with a band called the Stevies back when I was about 15 or 16. No, it was maybe when I was 20. And I've always loved it, so... On my first solo album, I wanted to do it again. I wrote it with a guy called Alan Davison. And that's, you know, it's called These Things.
Let's have it. Away you go. Oh, we'll have some of that. That was fantastic. Well done, chaps. That was lovely.
Thank you very much, mate.
That was good. Because I'll be honest, when you brought these two in, I thought, oh dear, we're going to be in trouble here. These two monkeys ain't going to clue. But, well, let's...
the monkeys.
Oh, don't, they're my favourite. The monkey. But it turns out you are both very, very talented boys. Well done.
Yeah,
well, hey, that's great. Very brave to do a song that you wrote at 20, because most blokes, when they're writing songs in their late teens...
Yeah.
They're a little bit clumsy.
I met a girl called Francesca.
I wanted to kiss her, but she said no. That's not bad,
yeah,
actually.
Actually, I think I'm going to use that.
We should sit down and have a little bit of a chat. Listen, the album is called The Kingmaker. It's John Terrell. Are you going out touring and supporting this? Is that what people do these days?
We're going to do the big chill house on the 12th at King's Cross, which is going to be 12th of September.
Yep.
The album comes out on the 8th on iTunes, and it's also going to be available on vinyl as well.
Oh, you old retro heads.
Well,
I am old. Tell me about it. These are proper songs, though. These are proper songs that you want to hear on a record.
To be honest, we're trying to create an album again, you know, for too long. I've been listening to other albums and it's been single, then not much else happening.
Yeah.
So hopefully we've created something that people want to have in their car and, you know, listen again and again on the vinyl player in their cars, obviously.
Keith Moon had a vinyl player
in
his car.
So did Marilyn Monroe as well.
Did she? John, listen, lovely to meet you. Mike and Andy,
lovely,
thank you so much
you
for coming
well.
In as well. Lovely
Thanks
to have you in. Superb stuff. It's John Terrell. The album is The Kingmaker. Is there a website or anything? If people
there is,
want to
johnterrell.com. Very straightforward.
Oh, you see, you got in there first and nabbed that one. Lovely. All right, well, listen, shall we have a little bit of... Let me just think what we're going to play. I know, let's have a little bit of this. Or not, as the case may be. There it is. Thank you very much. That was fantastic, wasn't it? He's a proper singer. He can really sing. Oh, it makes me sick. Hello, this is Ian Lee. BBC London 94.9, sitting in for Robert Elms. If you've just tuned in, oh, man, you missed that. John Terrell, that was superb. I enjoyed that, thoroughly enjoyed that. And you can, of course, get his album, The Kingmaker, when that comes out. We've been asking today, celebrating 90 years of the Radio Times. I've been asking what TV shows you've been on. James says, I was in the audience on the Esther Ranson show. Well, he spelt Ranson wrong, so that's slightly disrespectful. Afterwards, I had friends coming up to see me, coming up to me saying they'd seen me on it. Hashtag local celebrity. Well, there you go. Oh, on tomorrow's show. Now we're talking. Our musical route master, Russell Clark, will be talking. What's he talking about? The Beatles' Abbey Road. Well, there is a webcam that is focused, and I wish I knew the link off the top of my head. I don't, so I can't. But you can Google it, you'll find it. There is a webcam that is focused on the zebra crossing at Abbey Road, and it's just, you can spend an afternoon watching it. It's just a joy. It's just a joy to see mainly Italian and Japanese tourists holding up the traffic, and the number of cars that don't stop at that zebra crossing, because they know that once you stop there, you're going to be stuck there for a good 3, 4, 5 minutes sometimes with these tourists crossing the road trying to get that perfect photo. It's cracking. And Abbey Road, of course, is the Beatles' best album. That's right, it's the Beatles' best album. Also, tomorrow's show, Mark Mason, author of Move Along Please. He took 46 buses to get him from Land's End to John O'Groats. Oh, and Izzy Sutty coming in. Oh, I love Izzy. She's fantastic. Izzy Sutty will be popping in. She's in Peep Show, and she's a fantastic comedian. And she's always a joy. I'm looking forward to that. So that'll be all on tomorrow's show from midday. Sitting in for the rest of the week. And Gino De Campo, the celebrity chef, no doubt. It's a packed show. I don't even need to bother turning up. These guests are good enough to do it themselves. They can drive this bad boy on their own. If you want to send me an email between now and tomorrow's show, you can do ian.lee@bbc.co.uk.